All right, so we are here for our micronutrients module, copper section. And copper is one of those minerals that we don't talk too much about. It's not one of the sexy ones like magnesium and zinc and calcium, which get a lot of the press, but it does get a fair amount of press. A lot of times it gets negative press in its ability to interfere with zinc, but let's talk about it. And it also gets negative press in the terms of copper toxicity and pipes and things like that. But let's take a look at it and let's see. It is an important mineral and it has some definite functions in the human body. And all of this stuff is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. And it's not medical advice. So when you're working with people, just make sure that they know that you're giving them some education about how they can restore balance to their body. You're not telling them how they can cure or treat a disease. So let's look at copper. Copper is an essential trace element, so it's not needed in large amounts. It's found in the body in either the cuprous form, it's Cu1 plus, or the cupric, which is Cu2 plus form. Most of it's in the Cu2 plus form. It can easily accept or donate electrons, so that means that it's important for redox reactions, oxidation and reduction. And in scavenging free radicals. We don't often think about copper as an antioxidant. It's not referred to in a lot of the literature as an antioxidant, but indeed, anything that has the ability to participate in redox reactions scavenges free radicals because it can accept or donate, so it can go either way. Hippocrates is said to have prescribed copper compounds to treat diseases as early as 400 BC. So it's not new to our modern world to be working with different kinds of conditions nutritionally. So let's take a look at the digestion and absorption of copper. What you're seeing on the right-hand side, the picture, is an enterocyte, which is a cell that lines the gut. And you've got the villi and the microvilli on it, where it's the absorptive surfaces. Copper is bound to amino acids, which is very common for minerals to be either in foods or also in their supplement forms. You see, aspartate forms and citrate forms and all sorts of different forms. Well, actually, citrate's not an amino acid, but they're bound to amino acids is the most common. It needs HCl and pepsin to break it down. Obviously, that's really important to get the mineral away from the amino acid carrier. Proteolytic enzymes in the small intestine will further hydrolyze it. And then we have passive diffusion in the small intestine, mainly in the duodenum, whenever we have high concentrations of copper. So if somebody's taking in a lot of copper in their food or in a supplement, then it's going to passively diffuse from the small intestine into the bloodstream, mainly in the duodenum. So it doesn't even have to go all the way down to the ileum. When there's lower concentrations of copper, it's got to be actively transported across a gradient, is the way it's worded. Usually over 50% of it is absorbed, so it's not like you're losing most of it. Most minerals are not going to be 100% absorbed. Most nutrients are not going to be 100% absorbed because there's so much that goes into interfering with it. We'll talk about some of those interfering factors as well. There's certain things that enhance copper absorption. There's certain things that inhibit copper absorption. So let's take a look at them. There's three amino acids that help the copper to get absorbed across the intestinal lumen, through the enterocyte, and into the bloodstream. Those are histidine, cysteine, and methionine. There are also some organic acids that help it get absorbed. So citric, gluconic, lactic, acetic, and malic. And just as an aside, when we have various minerals, right, you have the form of a mineral. You may say, well, which form should I take of a mineral? And your clients are going to ask you that a lot. Should I take calcium citrate, calcium malate? That those are organic acids they're bound to. Or magnesium taurate, magnesium glycinate. Those are amino acids that they're bound to. So just wanted to make sure I pointed that out to you. So these are the guys that help the copper absorption, histidine, cysteine, and methionine. And on the organic acid side, citric, gluconic, lactic, acetic, and malic. There's also things that inhibit copper absorption. phytates, also known as phytic acid, which is found in some grains. And a lot of grains contain phytic acid, which binds the copper and other minerals, by the way, and drags it out of the body. Here's where the copper-zinc interaction comes into play. So when you get somebody supplementing more than 40 milligrams a day, the zinc you must be supplemented along with copper. Some people in some studies have shown as little as 18 milligrams a day of zinc causes copper excretion or inhibits the absorption. So whenever you're doing zinc, I would say in any decent amount, other than the little bit that's in a multi, you want to make sure that you're taking copper or letting people know to take copper. Large quantities of iron. Now, what are large quantities of iron? Studies didn't exactly say, but my guess is large quantities of iron would be the kinds of amounts that are recommended in pregnancy when or severe anemia. I've seen people get prescribed like 325 milligrams of iron. That's considered a large amount. The RDA is somewhere between 15 and 20 of iron, so I would say anything above the RDA, you might want to be thinking about putting some extra copper in there. Molybdenum doesn't seem to be gradient dependent. So again, if you're giving individual nutrients, you don't want to give a person copper at the same time as you give them molybdenum. Same thing is true of any of these. It's best if you don't give them together, you give them separate. Calcium as glucarate. So high doses, like super high doses that most people don't take. Same with phosphorus, 2,452 milligrams as glycerol phosphate or 2,382 as calcium deglucarate. That's very large. Most people don't take that much. Most people supplement calcium in the range of about 1,000. And then large doses of vitamin C. So when in doubt, add it in. And that's why taking, some kind of multi-mineral supplement, I often recommend some people get like a liquid multi-mineral supplement that has fulvic acid to help with the absorption to just maybe, as an insurance policy, especially when you're supplementing individual ones that they are deficient in. So you can avoid this. So what does copper do? Well, there's enzymes called cuproenzymes. And these cuproenzymes help in the formation of bone, hemoglobin, and red blood cells. It works in balance with zinc and vitamin C to form something called elastin, which is an important protein in the skin that keeps the skin elastic. As we age, the skin gets less elastic, it's less elastin being formed. So, copper could be something that could be helpful here. It's involved in the healing process, say bones and muscles and injuries. It's important in the Krebs cycle for energy production. Copper actually plays a role in hair and skin coloring. It's important for taste sensitivity, and we know that zinc's also important for taste sensitivity. It's required for healthy nerves and joints and for the formation of collagen. So let's talk about copper and energy production. So a copper-dependent enzyme called cytochrome C oxidase plays a critical role in the cellular energy production. It catalyzes, it means it accentuates, accelerates the reduction of the molecular oxygen to water. Cytochrome C oxidase also generates an electron gradient that's used by the mitochondria to create ATP, which is the energy currency of every cell. What about copper and connective tissue? Well, the enzyme is called lysyl oxidase, and it's required for the cross-linking of collagen and elastin. The fibers need to be cross-linked together, and the lysyl oxidase, a copper-dependent enzyme, is important for that. So this makes it important for the formation of strong but flexible connective tissue. We don't want like stiff connective tissue. We also don't want real loose connective tissue where we have joints that just flop all over the place. Lysyl oxidase also maintains the integrity of connective tissue in the heart and blood vessels. So it's not just in the muscular system where the connective tissue, it's in these vital organs. And it's also important in bone formation. There are a lot of nutrients involved in bone formation. It's not just about calcium. Let's take a look at copper and iron. the copper oxides and the ferrooxides. There's two different sets of oxidases. So ferrous iron, which is Fe2+, to ferric iron, Fe3+, is a form of iron that can be loaded into iron-carrying protein transferrin for the blood cell formation. The opposite is what happens when we're taking the ferric iron, which is the circulating form, and we want to store it into ferritin. And that's stored back as the ferrous iron in the storage. Ceruloplasmin is the way that it's a protein that carries copper around the bloodstream. 90% of the copper in the bloodstream is going to be carried by ceruloplasmin. There's membrane-bound ceruloplasmin, which is in the membranes of the cells. And then there's two other proteins called tafidestin and zyclopin. I cannot say foreign names at all. Sorry about that. They're found in the intestine and the placenta. So when you don't have enough ceruloplasm, you can end up getting iron overload in the liver, brain, and retina. Okay, because what happens? The oxidases, the copper oxidases, are required to pull that out of storage and store it back. The iron mobilization from storage sites is impaired in copper deficiency. So think about it this way. If you look at somebody and you see that their ferritin is really high and their circulating iron is low, it's possible that they have a copper deficiency. And then the ferrooxidase activity of ceruloplasmin is essential to the flux of iron in the body. So copper and iron are, you know, really, really important to have in balance with each other. Let's look at copper and the central nervous system. Remember dopamine, one of our neurotransmitters? It's one of the inhibitory dopamine transmitters, and it's an important function in the brain for keeping people calm and keeping them from going into depression. So the dopamine beta hydroxylase is a copper-dependent enzyme, and it converts from dopamine to norepinephrine. Now remember norepinephrine, what is that? It's noradrenaline. It's important for the fight-flight response, the sympathetic nervous system. Okay. The other thing is that it's really super important for, and more we're seeing diseases of myelin formation, so this is important to know, that the myelin sheet is made up of phospholipids, and the synthesis of those phospholipids is dependent on cytochrome C oxidase activity. So it's really critical that you're looking and making sure that your people who have MS or MS-like symptoms are sufficient in copper. Copper is important for pigmentation. There's an enzyme called tyrosinase, and it's required for the formation of melanin. Melanin is the pigment in the skin. Tyrosinase is formed in the melanocytes. Melanin plays a role in, of course, pigmentation. So your eyes, your skin, your hair. So pigmentation. And I would expect that perhaps depigmentation diseases might have something to do with copper. So if you're looking at people who are losing pigmentation in certain areas, you might consider looking for copper deficiency. Here's another one, and this is super important. One of the most important antioxidants in the body, I would say second only to glutathione, is superoxide dismutase. And it's a copper-dependent enzyme. And it catalyzes. So superoxide dismutase, a copper-dependent enzyme, catalyzes the conversion of superoxide radicals. These are really, you know, free radicals, very damaging, into making them inert into hydrogen peroxide. It can be reduced then to water by other antioxidants. So you have this cycle that's going on, that's constantly going on in the body of oxidation and reduction, oxidation and reduction. So there's two forms of SOD that contain copper. There's a copper zinc SOD, which is found within most cells of the body, including the red blood cells. And then there's extracellular SOD that's just dependent on copper that's found in the lungs and in the plasma. So zinc can be important for the red blood cell superoxide dismutase, for protecting the red blood cells from oxidation. So this is really important. And so even though copper is not like considered one of the heavy hitters or the top minerals that the lay people know about, it's an important mineral. It has some really important functions. Superoxide dismutase is serious stuff. So ceruloplasmin, as we said before, is the copper carrying molecule. It prevents free copper ions. Copper ions that are free, that are not bound to the ceruloplasmin, can cause oxidative damage. So the ceruloplasmin carries the copper around. The free copper and iron ions are powerful catalysts of free radical damage. So we really, ceruloplasmin is super important. The ceruloplasmin has the function, as we talked about earlier, for ferroxidase activity. So the oxidation of the ferrous iron. So it facilitates loading the iron into the transport protein. So we need to have the ceruloplasmin to be able to take the iron out of storage and put it on the transport protein to be carried around. And it can prevent the free iron ions, Fe2 plus, from participating in the free radicals. So it's really, really important that we have good levels of copper to prevent anemia. So a deficiency of copper can lead to an anemia, or an anemia that looks kind of strange in that the storage of the ferritin stores are high relative to the iron in the serum. So let's look at gene expression. Cellular copper levels enhance or inhibit the transcription of specific genes. The transcription is when the genes are activated and synthesize protein. So copper is important in the synthesis of certain proteins in the body. It can regulate the expression of genes by increasing the level of intracellular oxidative stress. So a number of these signal transduction pathways are activated in response to oxidative stress. What does that mean? Is that we talk about genetics and epigenetic expression, and sometimes these genes are turned on by oxidative stress. Like the body needs more of a specific reaction, and it's turned on by the oxidative stress. And we when we have this regulation, this overregulation or underregulation of gene expression, it can affect detoxification, specifically of the reactive oxygen species. So you basically think about the body is constantly subject to being rusted on the inside. Things get rusted when you leave something out, metals out in the rain and in the oxygen, they get wet and then they turn kind of rusty. That's oxidation. And that's what happens inside the body. And it's a pretty graphic way to look at it. That's what happens inside the body when free radical damage is happening. So it's really important to have these free radical molecules happening at a good in a good amount. Again, let's look at copper and iron. An adequate copper nutritional status is necessary for the normal iron metabolism and red blood cell formation. Ceruloplasmin is required for iron transport to the bone marrow for red blood cell formation. So now we're talking about it being important for the red blood cell formation, not just for the oxygen carrying capacity of the red blood cells, but for the red blood cell formation. So anemia can be copper deficiency. A lot of times we just go looking for iron deficiency, B12 deficiency, folate deficiency, but copper can be involved. And that may be the missing link when people say, well, I just keep taking iron supplements and nothing seems to help bring my iron levels up. They want to be looking at copper when you hear that in a patient's history. If you take in too much iron, like we said earlier, if somebody's taken like a really high dose iron because they have a deficiency or they're pregnant, that can interfere with copper absorption. So you have to make sure that you're not giving them together and that you give extra copper to make up for that. Let's take a look at copper and zinc. Well, taking zinc of more than 50 milligrams a day for an extended period of time can result in copper deficiency. But like I said earlier, it can also result from lower levels of zinc over long, prolonged period of times. So it's been shown at minimum of 18.5 milligrams. So there's a particular intestinal cell protein in the wall of the intestine, inside the enterocytes, called metallothionein. And it binds metals and prevents their absorption by trapping them in the intestinal cells, like in the cells. They don't go into the bloodstream. They come from the blood and they're trapped in there and hopefully detoxified, because that's the intention. But it has a stronger affinity for copper than for zinc. So if you have high levels of metallothionine induced by taking a lot of zinc, it's going to cause a decrease in the copper absorption, because when you have a lot of zinc, it causes more of these metallothionines to be induced, to be created, and then they then bind up the copper. So even though you have a lot of zinc, you're not binding up the zinc, you're binding up more of the copper. Okay. So let's look at vitamin C. Vitamin C can increase the absorption of copper. It reduces copper from the ferrous, the 2+ to the 1+ form. Vitamin C supplementation, 1,500 milligrams a day for 2 months, resulted in a significant decline in ceruloplasmin oxidase activity. Well, how many people do you know that are taking more than 1,500 milligrams a day of vitamin C? Lots. Okay, so it's important that we're well-rounded in the nutrition, that we're either making sure that they eat high copper foods or take a copper supplement if necessary. Even supplements as low as 605 milligrams a day for 3 weeks resulted in decreased ceruloplasmin oxidase activity. Neither of those studies found vitamin C supplementation to adversely affect copper nutritional status. So even though they interfered with the ceruloplasmin, we didn't see the copper levels going down. But let's say, how do you know if somebody has a copper deficiency? And where do they happen? Where's the prevalence? Well, low birth weight infants and young children, and it's uncommon, but it does happen. That's where it most likely happens. In cases of severe copper deficiency, their ceruloplasmin levels may fall to 30% of normal. So that's going to affect what? That iron, right? The release of iron from stores. Hypocupremia, which is deficient copper, is observed in certain genetic disorders of copper metabolism. So there's one called aceruloplasminemia, and also in Wilson's disease. And in Wilson's disease, we're binding up the copper, or we're having a copper excess in the liver, and it can affect the liver and liver functions. So let's look at the most common signs of copper deficiency. Anemia, that's unresponsive to iron, but then it gets corrected by copper. So you're probably going to see a lot of folks with anemia that's not responsive to iron. People are taking iron, and nothing happens. You'll see them with low white blood cells in the neutrophils, so neutropenia. So we know that white blood cells are the first line of defense in the immune system. So neutrophils are often related to bacteria. So if we have abnormally low numbers of neutrophils, we may be compromising the immune system in terms of its ability to get rid of the bacteria, which increases the susceptibility to infection. Other signs, well, we talked about it as being involved in the pigmentation, in melanin formation. So loss of pigmentation, neurological symptoms, and impaired growth. The impaired growth is a less common symptom, but still can happen theoretically anyway. We have osteoporosis and other abnormalities in bone formation. And finally, it can affect cardiovascular function. And that's probably related to the circulation. So who's at risk? Well, the high-risk individuals happen to be infants and children that are only fed cow's milk formula, premature infants, especially low birth weight, infants that have prolonged diarrhea, and infants and children recovering from malnutrition. Those are the highest risks. So it's really compromised children and infants. Other people that are at risk are people with malabsorption syndromes, like celiac, like SPRU, like short bowel syndrome due to surgery. I would guess also, I would add Crohn's disease to that as well, because that can affect absorption if it's in the small intestine. Crohn's disease in the large intestine isn't going to affect it, but Crohn's disease can be throughout. People with cystic fibrosis are at a higher risk of copper deficiency. And people who are on IV, total parenteral nutrition, also known as TPN, basically they're not getting any nutrients. They're relying on the formula that's being given to them in the hospital. And a lot of those do lack copper. And yeah. And then excessive zinc, over 50 milligrams a day. So when in doubt, you know, you supplement or you let people know where to get high copper foods. So let's look at acquired copper deficiency as opposed to a genetic copper deficiency. You can get a neurologic syndrome that includes central nervous system demyelination, polyneuropathy, means neuropathy in multiple areas, multiple limbs, myelopathy, it's related to the muscles, inflammation of the optic nerve. This sounds a little bit like diabetes complications, doesn't it? Right? We have some neuropathies. We have some problems with the eyes. It can look like a diabetic complication. There's a, when we look at the intestines and it's increased, it might suggest a malabsorption syndrome like Menkes. That's just a disease that's related to copper absorption. So when we replace like just 2 milligrams a day of copper, it normalizes the copper and ceruloplasmin concentrations. It stabilizes this condition and it significantly improves the quality of life. So it's not much, 2 milligrams a day of copper. Now, this is an acquired disease. This is not an inborn error of metabolism. This is something that people come up with. Well, for whatever reason, their copper is low. It could be because of excess zinc for long periods of time. It could be because of an absorption problem. It could be because of taking in a lot of the things that are interfering. And it could be a lack of dietary copper. But an inherited copper deficiency is something called Menkes disease and then occipital horn syndrome. There's mutations in the ATP7A gene. I haven't looked that one up in 23andMe either. Because you know when people have this disease. It's not like it's like something you're going to find out by 23andMe. It impairs the transport of intracellular copper, so the ability of the copper to be transported between cells. It causes an accumulation in the cytosol of enterocytes and vascular endothelial cells. Enterocytes, right, are your gut lining cells, and vascular endothelial cells are the cells that line the blood cells. And forgive me for repeating those things, but I know some of this is new to some folks, and the more you hear it, you go, oh yeah, enterocytes, I know what those are now, as opposed to you going, oh yeah, I forget, what are enterocytes? So results... these mutations can result in systemic copper deficiency and decreased cuproenzyme. So all those different enzymes we talked about, including SOD, they're going to be deficient in someone who has this gene mutation. It affects a lot of stuff. It affects the copper accumulation in the blood-brain barrier. So the transport of copper is affected. It affects the neurons. And some of the symptoms would be seizures, connective tissue disorders, subdural hemorrhage, hair abnormalities like kinky hair. So if you have kinky hair, don't go thinking you have this disease. Probably not. The occipital horn syndrome people have muscular hypotonia, low muscle tone, connective tissue abnormalities, and problems with the occipital bone. Subcutaneous injections of copper histidine are used to bypass these defective intestinal absorption and improve copper metabolic function in these patients. Copper entry into the brain remains limited. So where they may, the body-wide symptoms may improve, the brain stuff doesn't improve all that much because it's hard to get it into the brain. So let's look at copper toxicity. It's rare in the population, but it happens acutely. It happens as a result of copper-containing containers where beverages are stored, especially acidic kind of beverages because it can leach those minerals out, and contaminated water supplies. We used to do a lot of copper pipes, and some places still use copper pipes, and that can contaminate the water supplies. So you want to make sure, it's a simple question, and a lot of people, you'd be surprised it still don't do it. Are you drinking tap water or filtered water? Because a lot of times people are still drinking out of the tap, and this can be a problem. Some of the acute toxicity symptoms would be abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. You're not going to see that very much. What you're going to see is more of the long-term type of stuff, the low-grade stuff. So some of the serious signs would be liver damage, kidney failure, coma, and death. Pretty severe. Long-term complications, you're going to affect the liver, okay? Because too much copper gets into the liver and it just clogs it up and damages it. There is a disease called Wilson's disease, and it basically causes a hardening of the liver, almost like alcoholic cirrhosis. Copper and your hormones. Women tend to have higher copper levels and more symptoms related to copper imbalance, including yeast infections, migraine headaches, adult onset acne, or adult continuing into adulthood acne, menstrual dysfunction, and even depression. So when we have somebody who's got excess copper as a woman, oftentimes they're estrogen dominant. Men can be estrogen dominant too, however. It's not just something that's linked just to women. Men, as they go through what we call andropause, as their testosterone levels drop, and because of the xenotoxins, the xenoestrogens in the environment, men become estrogen dominant as well. Women with bioavailable copper are often low in estrogen, but copper toxic ones are high. So we see a link between estrogen and copper. Men tend to be zinc dominant, although many men do have symptoms of copper toxicity, including depression, anxiety, and other symptoms. Okay, so not as common in men. We see more zinc deficiencies in women as well. So let's look at the allowances. Anywhere from 1.3 milligrams in lactating women down to 0.2 milligrams in kids 0 to 6 months. Okay, the tolerable upper limit was posted as 10 milligrams per day in adults, both men and women. We set the daily value, you know how they have those on the labels, the DV, is 2 milligrams per 2,000 calories. So, it's a little bit different from the daily allowance. It's a little bit higher than the daily allowance, but that's what we see. Now, if somebody is only eating 1,000 calories, they might only be getting 1 milligram per calorie. Some food sources. Some of our favorite foods are listed here. I love cashews and sunflower seeds and hazelnuts and almonds and walnuts and lentils, garbanzo beans, lima beans, soybeans, tempeh, white mushrooms, beet greens, turnip greens, spinach, and kale. So there's a lot of really good sources. So let's take a look at how much. This is again taken from WH Foods. It's very small on the slides, but you've got the link, and I highly recommend that you go there whenever you want to check these things out. Sesame seeds seem to be the highest, with 1.47 milligrams in a quarter of a cup, 206 calories. Not that much, and that's quite amount of copper. So we could see why if you're eating a good whole foods kind of diet, you're probably not going to be copper deficient. Cashews, okay, what is that? 0.88 milligrams. And remember, we need in lactating women, we needed what? 1.3, okay? In pregnant women, so in just most of us, 19 years plus, 0.9 milligrams is all we need. So, just a little bit of sesame seeds and cashews and mushrooms and greens. You know, greens we usually eat much more. Beet greens I don't eat much of because of the oxalates in them, but spinach are high in oxalates. Interesting, all the foods that are high in oxalates, kale. But look how easy it is to meet the daily requirement of copper. And that's why copper deficiency is rare. But you might see that in people. Yeah, and you might see copper excess. I remember seeing one case of copper excess where a guy was just eating like an unbelievable amount of macadamia nuts, which aren't listed here because they're not a common food for people to be getting. But he was eating a lot of nuts and his copper levels were high. How do you test? Well, you can look at a blood test. You can look at copper in the blood along with ceruloplasmin. So you want to look at the ceruloplasmin, you can look at the free copper. So the things that you'd want to look at that for were Wilson's, copper storage, copper poisoning, copper deficiency. 24-hour urine test, copper elimination, copper storage in the liver. So that's the cases. Like if you're looking for determining if somebody has Wilson's disease or excess copper, a copper poisoning, a copper deficiency, you'd look in the blood. If you're looking to see how well are they eliminating and how much they have stored in their liver, you can do a 24-hour urine, and you can also do hair analysis. And I'd be interested in to see how that shows up in the hair analysis. So there are some drug interactions. Penicillin binds copper and enhances its elimination. It's actually used to bind copper and help people with Wilson's disease. And it dramatically increases the urinary increase of copper. Antacids can increase with a copper absorption when they're used in high amounts. And here's some resources. There's a bunch of different studies and see the various national databases. And there's some good stuff that you can read about. The Linus Pauling Institute has a lot of good stuff on many of the minerals. Doesn't have it on all, but they have some good information and some good studies. So if you want to go deeper with any of these, that's what I recommend. So that's the end of our copper presentation.